Hello. It's the motherfucking Millennial Miha podcast.
Welcome back to the Millennial Miha podcast. I am excited because today I get to interview a homegirl of mine, Prisca Dorcas Mojica Rodriguez. She's coming in right now at 1:30. She's live from Nashville, and we're going to talk about her book, Four Brown Girls with Sharp Edges and Tender Hearts. This book is going all over the internet. It's going crazy, and there's a reason why. So she should be coming and joining us soon. But until then, we're about to just, you know, get a little vibe going with some Selena, because we need it. It's Sunday. We're chilling. And I'm feeling good because I'm excited to talk about this book. I've been listening to it via audiobook, and that's, for me, that's a better way of consuming books, because I like to move around when I'm reading, and it makes it easier to do that. But this book is, you know, it says here, for generations, brown girls have had to push against powerful forces of sexism, racism, and classism, often feeling alone in the struggle. By founding Latina Rebels, Prisca Dorcas has created a community to help women fight together. In For Brown Girls with Sharp Edges and Tender Hearts, she offers wisdom and a liberating path forward for all women of color. She's here, and she's going to join us in the chat.
There she is!
Hello! Oh my gosh.
Prisca! How are you?
Good, how are you? It's been forever.
Let me turn you up. Let me see. I'm used to having a lot of technical difficulties because I'm new being in the studio here. So it's good to see you, girl. How are you?
It's good to see you. I'm trying to find a cute filter because you look...
Yeah, I have a really cute, my favorite filter. That one works. That one definitely works.
It's dramatic.
Oh, dude, my God. I'm so happy to see you.
Likewise.
How long has it been that we actually... We met once in... 2017.
I think, yeah. It was it
2017? Latina Rebels Chingona Fire Meetup.
Yeah.
In downtown LA.
That was it. That was our one.
Our one and done. And I remember when I met you, you had half black hair, half white hair. I was like, I love her. Cruella, all the vibes.
Yeah. That was
it. We had a little night on the town together. So welcome to the Millennial Miha podcast, girl. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you for having me and reaching out. I'm so excited. Of course.
I was telling everyone before you came that the way I am consuming your book is via audiobook, and it's, for me, that's the best way because I like to move around when I'm like, I have to move, and the audiobook allows me to do that. But with listening to your voice, I feel like I'm talking to you. So I talk back to you as you're talking, and I forget that you can't hear me. But yeah, I was legit having a whole conversation with you, like, oh no, they didn't. Like, you know, some of the stories you tell in the book are very like, upsetting and triggering, and so you're like, and knowing, being able to say that you're someone I've actually met, I like feel low-key mad, and I'm like, it's not gonna go down like that. So hearing your voice is really cool in the audiobook. What was that process like?
It was weird. Like, emotionally it was weird. I hadn't gotten to the place where I can read a lot of those stories without crying.
Uh-huh.
So I was like,
I heard
like
it.
A toxic masculinity. Yeah. Like,
I definitely heard it in your voice.
I definitely had to do different takes. We got the best we could on some areas.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting because I didn't expect it to be like emotional in a recording studio publishing my first book. So,
yeah. When I read my audiobook, when I like did the recording of it, I did the audiobook years at, so I released my book in 2016, and I didn't read the audiobook or create that until maybe 2019. Oh, and so reading it back was a really different experience because it had been so long.
Yeah.
And there were moments too where I had to stop on certain poems, like, whoa, I thought I was past this and I can't even get through the damn poem, you know?
Yeah. I also felt like I guess this is a thing. Like, I'm just never going to not have this reaction with some of these topics. Yeah. Because it is like you mourn what you want, what you wished would have happened to you when you were younger, what you wish people had said to you. You mourn all that. And it's hard to like get over it, I think.
Definitely. definitely. Speaking of, okay, well, let's change a little bit. Okay, so happy Halloween. It's Halloween.
I know.
I'm a leopard, apparently. A cheetah. What are you?
I'm nothing. I'm not good at that shit. I grew up with, like, Hallelujah nights. I've actually only dressed up a handful of times as an adult.
Yeah? Dude, I don't know. I feel like it takes so much effort. It's just... But I truly admire the people who do dress up because, like, wow, it's creative and, like, they put effort into it. And yeah. I want to be that person, but I'm just not.
No se me sale at all. I wish. I always have a vision.
Yeah. You're like, this would be so cute if someone else wanted to do all the effort that it took to do this costume. Yeah, exactly. It's cute for someone, not me, though.
Yeah.
So thank you for being here, dude. Like, I have loved watching you shine with this book release and just seeing all the different places you have come up, all the podcasts. I was watching on the news a little while ago. And also, my favorite shit ever was when I was watching you on the news, there's this white guy interviewing you. And, like, you can just see your face, but, like, I don't know if they notice, but it's just funny because the way they're, like, they're bringing up white supremacy, and it's just, like, it sounds weird coming out of his mouth, and then you're, like, well, if you want to have the conversation, like, you're kind of, like, all right, let's have it then, you know, yeah. So that was really, like, enjoyable to watch and seeing, and you've gotten to speak about these topics of colonialism, colorism, meritocracy, all this stuff, and you've gotten to speak with these people who maybe this is their first time being introduced to these concepts because that's just not on their radar. What's that been like navigating the interview process, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm used to it because, like, my parents don't know a lot of this stuff. Like, I don't come from people who have access to this level of information or, like, the privilege to sit and think about a lot of this stuff too, or like access to good schooling where they would have been taught proper history. Cause even that is very, we don't get a lot of that. So yeah, I don't come from people who know it. So I'm used to having to translate stuff and I'm used to being like, how does this make sense? If I was just having a gossip night with my girlfriends, like that's like the impetus for it. So like doing the interviews was just like the same stream of thought, taking a lot of academic stuff mainstream doesn't happen well often. Yeah. So,
you know, cause to me, this book was a redistribution of wealth, like a redistribution of knowledge, which I know that was your intention. It comes across very clearly. And it really does make, you know, that saying, you know, like it's neither radical nor revolutionary if it's not accessible to the poor. That's really what this book makes me think about, because you not only, you do say some words that I went to college and I remember, I'm like, okay, I kind of know what that word means. But then you also say more in kind of just regular Prisca language, just like if you're talking to a homegirl. So it balances it out in this way where it's like, I might not have understood the thing you just said, but now with the context of the story you just gave, now I totally understand it.
Yeah. Cause I'm an immigrant kid and I had to listen to a lot of context clues to figure out what was happening everywhere.
Girl, context clues. I'm not an immigrant child, but context clues for me with the learning disability has been like everything. I remember listening to you talk about in the book about how before you actually knew how to read, you were so good at memorizing and pretending to know what, you know, that was relatable for me as a kid growing up with a learning disability who was like really bright. So really bright, but then I struggled like really hard with simple things in school. And so it didn't really like, it was hard to see. So when you said that, I was like, wow, you know, what was that like?
I mean, I think it was, I was playing catch up on everything. We moved here. I didn't know how to read and I was like 7 turning 8. And it was just, I was catching up like cultural things. Like girls didn't really hold hands here. It was like weird. Meanwhile, me and my cousins held hands, like little things that I was starting to pick up fashion. Like it was really important for us in Nicaragua, like our school shoes were like polished leather shoes that we polished every night. We came to the US, everybody had sneakers. Like it was little things that you start picking up and you're just like, how do I catch up? And reading was just one of those things. It was like, how do I catch up? I need to do something. And so I was just like overextending myself just to seem just a little less weird and a little less immigrant and a little less the topic of conversation as an other rather than an insider. So that was the same thing with reading. It was like, once I figured out how to read, which took me a while, it was like, okay, I hit the ground running. Let's go. I'm going to yeah. library. I'm checking out 100 books because that was the max at the public library. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, I'm here to stay.
Yeah. And yeah, it's like that mentality. It seems like you have this type of like leader personality that's just like a natural kind of like trailblazer kind of person, you know. It just, and that really stands out in a lot of the things that in every single time you speak, but also in the things that you've done, even with creating Latina Rebels, you know, it's like this, like, I'm the first to do it. And it's like, there's this sense of those of us that are watching you, there's this sense of fearlessness that we see, but in the book, you let us into the fact that it was actually so much fear involved in this, and kind of like letting us see behind the curtain and letting other people see, like, I don't have anything that you don't have, you know, like we're on the same level. So if I can do it, you can do it, you know? Where does that come from? That kind of like leader trailblazer part of your personality? Is that something you learned from maybe like a family member, or is that something you were just happened to be born with?
You know, it's like the power of reframing is very potent right now. Cause I've always thought of it as like, I'm just really insecure about having been an outsider for so long that if I can help other people not feel like an outsider or not feel like unsupported or not feel like I remember there's like a really famous Latino theologian, and I asked him, like, I don't know why I asked him, but his response was basically, I make life harder for Latinx students because academia is going to be hard for them. And so I need to train them for the worst. And I was like, yeah, what I want to do is make things easier.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and that's like my pedagogy. It's like how I move through the world. And I'd never thought of it as like me having like a lot of grit that nobody else is capable of doing. I think it was like very insecure with a lot of things that happened in my life. And I'm just like, that shouldn't happen. People should have tools to navigate things better.
What's your sign? Sorry.
Leo. Okay. The three.
Yeah. The three.
Okay. Leo, sun, rising Cancer, and Gemini moon.
Okay. Okay. Cause so in the Leo thing, does that like a take charge? Like, I know, like, control, like, I got this. Is that, like, from that?
The fake confidence, for sure, comes from the Leo.
The fake confidence. Let's talk about that, because a lot of people see me also and perceive me to be, like, very, very confident. And people that know me kind of, like, behind the scenes will just be able to tell you that, man, I'm the one that struggles the most with believing in myself. But I won't let you know that.
Yeah,
like, I know how to make myself appear, or to paint my face, or to get ready and make, because I know the cues that you need to know in order to perceive me as confident. And it's like, dude, if I would have just took all that energy and just actually put it towards liking myself and being confident in what I'm doing, then I could have been confident a long time ago. But that is kind of like that, the way our brains work. I don't know. You know, it's like we kind of had to reverse engineer this whole process. Talk to me about that for you.
It's like that sharp edge that I write about. It was that, it was that whole, I kept seeing that person, that difficult daughter. Like, I kept seeing her when I was writing this book. I was like, you know, we're the ones that get called bitches. We're the ones who get like, who like cry alone at home. And we're like, you should have been tougher, bitch, to yourself.
Wait.
But like, that's like who I wrote for, because that's me. That's 100% me. And it is a trauma response. There's a lot of stuff that happens in why we do walk in the world and the ways that we do walk in the world. But it doesn't mean it's not an amazing tool that some of us have met. Like I said, we've managed to chisel it down into a weapon of self-defense. Like, the world has chiseled us down, and we're gonna be okay. But fuck you for doing that to us.
Yeah, no, that's the over, like, there's this feeling or this theme of empowerment and hope, but also not shying away from identifying the ways in which we have been wronged, you know, and then calling it out, but then also not like using it as an excuse, like saying, okay, these are the barriers and this is how you get around them. You know, like someone, I think it was LA Times, called your book a manual for tapping into brown girls' power. I thought that was like one of the greatest, like shortest ways to put it, you know. It really is a manual, and that is that's like an important thing, like to put on your shoulders, like I wrote the manual, like, you know, like maybe I imagine how you might feel, you know. I know a lot of us like brown creators in this like Latinx sphere of social media have written books and created things and put in things out, but when you get to do it at the scale that you're doing it at, this puts you at the forefront of all of that. So how does that feel? Because in the book, you talk a lot about imposter syndrome and feeling like when you first got your book deal, like, I can't even believe this shit. I can't even believe this shit. Like, so, you know, having to be kind of like now the voice at the, cause at the larger level, you know, that's what it would be. And so how does that feel to you?
I hope I give homage. Yeah. I hope I honor a lot of like the people who shaped me, like my acknowledgements. I was very clear. Like I stand on some strong, strong shoulders. And so it feels weird to feel like that much significance on me. But then I remember, like, there's a lot of people standing there behind.
Yeah. And me. You reference a lot. You reference them a lot. And that was part of, you know, the research of the book before you started the book, you know, because I remember you posting the books you were reading in order to prep for that, which also like I didn't even realize that I was like following the process of the book until the book came and I'm like, oh, that's what she was doing, which I was like, okay, girl, marketing, hello, I see you. Like that really worked out because, you know, you use the hashtag and I'm like, okay, I see what she's doing here. But because, you know, later when I was looking at the books that you had, some of them are like Body Keep Score, It Didn't Start With You, Saving Paradise, Sister Outsider, The Bridge Called My Back, and All About Love. Like, these are these, like, classic books, you know, written for the purpose of our education about ourselves. Yeah. And so talk to me about the research that you did for the book, and what books do you feel like made the most impact on yours, and why?
Oh my gosh, a lot. The research. So when I started it, the hashtag for doing my bibliography was because like books are expensive and I was like, people should still have access to the knowledge. People are always messaging me like, what's your bibliography? What do you read to like get to who you are or whatever?
Yeah.
So I'm like, this is a really great way to just like, okay, just this hashtag. But it is this like breath of like this wide ranging, it's so many fields, it's so many scholars. A lot of those books are really dense, and unfortunately I had to go out of my way in grad school to read most of them. In my program, they really still honored like the dead white men canon. Usually those books were like in the, you know, suggested reading for your syllabus.
Yeah.
So I've been
not on the required, but the suggested. Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to edify yourself on your time off after I make you read a book a week, plus all your other professors that make you read a book a week, then read the suggested list.
Man, yeah, very, you know, when you talk about all that, about like the navigating that world, you know, because essentially this book is about, it's about brown girls navigating spaces that are not built for them, with them in mind, you know? So talk to me about doing that again in the publishing world now.
Oh, it's like a wild ride, but yeah. I feel like I'm learning a lot all the time, but it is like wild. I didn't know that most authors don't get to pick their covers. I didn't know that. I didn't know how, how significant acknowledgments are for like networking at this level. I was like, what do you mean? But yeah. I didn't thank you because I didn't like little things. I'm like becoming really aware. There's codes of ethics and there's understandings. And I'm just like, I am so behind. I'm dropping the ball everywhere. And I have to figure out first, like I did in grad school, figure out what's the playbook. And once I see it, and then I can be like, fuck you, and do something else. But I don't have the full.
It's kind of like a repeat of your experience at Vanderbilt. You know, it's just in another different, it's a different institution.
Yeah. Yeah.
the you know, the institutionalized racism that you talk about in the book, like those stories piss me off, you know, like the story about you in high school and going to your counselor and wanting to get AP classes and kind of being told that he's not going to set you up for failure and not wanting to let you sign up for these classes, and you having to bring your mom in, you know, and kind of like advocating for yourself, but like your mom's body is just there, you know, she's like not speaking English, and yeah. He's just having her there is like, you, that's a lot for a kid to be doing, you know, like yeah. you're parentified at a really early age, when, especially if, when you're having, you know, an immigrant experience, you're having to do that. So talk to me about that, you know, advocating for yourself.
It was a constant thing. And I think out of my three siblings, I was tasked to do it more. I don't know if it's an eldest immigrant daughter thing, but I definitely did the majority of it. That sometimes I'd be like, why isn't Linda and Richard doing anything? Like, yeah. What the hell? But I was like constantly, like I remember having to beg like cops if we got stopped or pulled over, because my dad's like, please tell him to get me off. I don't have a lot of money. And it's, and I'm just like, can, my dad says,
yeah, and, like, imagine. You're
just like, that's just what you have to do. And so I think it feeds into like this book. I've been like translating life my whole life, and then translating my goals through systems and power, mm-hmm. navigating it with the code of ethics that exists. And then that spot was like, my mom was authority in a public
yeah,
school.
In there, in his eyes, in that moment.
Yeah.
Even though in another setting, she might have zero authority to him.
Yeah.
You know, that it, there's like so many layers of the stuff you talk about, and it, and what kind of made me use my college brain, like I graduated college in 2011 and I just never looked back. I was like, it ain't for me. So I just kept going in another direction. But it reminded me of that college brain. I feel like when I graduated college, I was still writing poetry. I was going to the poetry lounge. And that was like my, I went in at the beginning of college and I was like writing kind of like more shorter poetry that was just more in my voice. And as I went through college, by the time I was done, my poems sounded like essays and had all these words that I would never use in regular normal language. So it took me a long time to get my voice back. Yeah. Do you feel like you've had that experience?
Oh yeah. When I first, you can even go, if you go to the Huffington Post, I have a profile. I have two, actually. I don't know why, but they split them at one point. But if you go to my oldest thing, I think it's called Spicy ? Is my first thing I published. And it's like 18 lines. It was just me trying to figure out how to say, how to talk to people again. How to like talk to normal people that weren't just like in these four walls and with the access to talk about everything all the time. So yeah, it took me a while to start. I had to work my way through essays for years before I feel like I could write a book like this, and it is still a compilation of my essays that I've been writing for years. But yeah, you like forget to talk a little.
Yeah, and you forget what your voice sounds like, because you're so focused on what it needs to sound like to be accepted in this environment.
Yeah.
And so you end up having to translate your genius into MLA format, and it that just strips something. I really did feel like stripped of something, that again did take me a long time to get my creative voice, my authentic voice that wasn't being filtered through education or academia. So, you know, we talk also about in the institutionalized racism part, you know, being told that you can't write as actually being an English major and being told you can't write and being given the opportunity to write your paper in Spanish because they thought that since that was your first language. Again, these moments had me mad. Like I was listening, you know, these are upsetting moments. The point of these stories is to what?
I think it is to start to do that spark. If people get angry and are like, oh my, if they get angry because they're like, oh my God, those are similar stories to mine and fuck that shit, then wow, we did it.
Yeah.
And if people get angry and they're like, no, I wish that I'd been better told. This story has so many more nuances. I could do it better, even better. But if it's like creating a response, I think that's the point of art. It's supposed to create something. It's supposed to ignite something, and really great art will do that, and I hope that it like ignites something in you. And if it could be little, like I think that's what I'm really adamant at the end, like liberation is like lifelong. Like at the beginning I had a very different, very limited amount of training and very little. I was just starting to process all the things I was learning, so just starting to address like internalized anti-blackness, internalized fat phobia. You start, but you have so many blinders that we've been given our whole lives that you literally just start somewhere. Even if you enter a room and it's a bunch of people with a bunch of genders you don't know, and you just say, "Hey, y'all," instead of "Hi, guys."
Yeah.
Uh-huh. If you just shift that if whatever, if that's the one thing that you start with, like let that be a thing, but let it be at the beginning of something. But it'll take time, and it takes like a lot of grace based on like the different lives we're all living and the amount of power or lack of power we might have in our homes and in our lives. So it's hard to be like, what do I want? When I know people live, especially oppressed people and women of color, we live the circumstances that this world has been able to give us. So we need to have grace with each other, but start somewhere.
Yeah. Speaking of that, you know, we live with the circumstances that other people created for us. It was recently the Latina Equal Pay Day. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious now, this is a random question I even have on here, but I'm curious about like when it comes to equal pay as an author and publishing world, is like, what's that been like? And how have you been navigating that part? Because been a writer forever, but I mean, you're entering this new, like a pro space that's like, must be different. So what's that been like?
I don't know. People are really secretive. I'm one of the few people that's willing to tell people about my advances. And I know some other people's advances, but they don't want me to tell anybody what their advances are. It's very secretive. I'm a first time book writer. And so I'm a risk for a publisher in terms of like, will I finish the book? So my payment got split into three. I was given 75K, but it was split into upon signing, I get 25. Then when I'm done with my whole manuscript, I get the next 25. And when the book publishes, I get the next 25. So that's how it worked. They broke it down. But I got offered a lot. The range was huge. So then I don't know what's, you know, you want, there's certain industries that are very saturated, certain industries that are like, it's certain that it's going to do well. So they have bigger, like specifically fiction or young adults, like it's a huge market. And so they get bigger advances, but nobody talks about it. I honestly have no idea. And I wish I did. I wish people were more honest, but I think we would just discover the fact that white mediocre men are consistently going to be making better than any of us will. Because I was offered an advance
for doing less good work. Like it's always the mediocrity just kind of like permeates all aspects of the whole thing. Like it's like, really, this is not that great compared to what I could have done at half the price. Wow. Or
like American Dirt, that $1 million advance. I was like, oh, I didn't even know it got like that. Oh.
Like, okay, speaking of that book, if nobody remembers what controversy was, shout out to Julissa, who actually went and put that girl in her place on the Oprah show.
Stop. I didn't watch it. I was trying to avoid everything. I was like, mess.
So basically, if you guys don't know what we're talking about, there was a book written called American Dirt by a
white woman.
I don't know how to, a woman who, yeah. I whose race is, I guess, ambiguous because I don't really know, but she stated that she identifies as Cuban, I believe. She wrote a book about an undocumented experience, like as though she was living that, but it wasn't. And so it kind of turned into this controversy where even the decorations at the party were like barbed wire on the fucking candles or some crazy shit like that. Like, just tone deaf. And then Oprah puts it on her, you know, bestseller list or whatever. And then our community did not like that. And so our community, one of the voices of our community, Julissa Arce, went in. She just went in. And I remember seeing that and feeling so, like, proud. Like, okay, we don't need to say much. She went and did her thing. That book, so did you read it, or what was your experience with that book?
No way. it happened around the time after I had interacted with that publisher, and what I was offered was 25 or 15, I think. So
and she got a million?
Yeah. So I was like, is this disrespect?
Well, I mean, it's really like to the story that they were willing to, that she was willing to tell versus the story you were willing to tell.
Yeah.
Like it's like pimping your trauma, you know? And yeah, they'll pay more for that because that's what people want to hear about immigrants. They want to hear this story of struggle. They want to, and not that those things aren't true, but it's like, Jesus Christ, can we move on? There are other stories and other aspects of our identity that need to be shared in this like media sphere because they have this one picture of us.
Yeah. And it just centers the white gaze. Like you said, like it is like what people want to hear. And we're just like celebrating somebody from not from the community doing the same thing. We're like, okay, what are you paying the writers whose experiences match what they're writing about then?
Yeah. Back to your book. We went on a little tangent there, but back to your book. In part of it, you talk about code switching a lot, which is something that if you've gone to college or if you work in a, you know, a white company or if you're in white spaces, me, I grew up around white people. So code switching is just like, it comes so naturally to me. That you say in the book, code switching is for the benefit of white people, even if they aren't in the room. Can you explain more about that?
It's the, being the there's so much to this that I don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
If I'm on that, because it's code switch, like mannerisms, it's code switch, even the clothes that we wear. it's like how we say professionalism. What does that mean? Who is it to the benefit of? Like, it is very like it has everything you can imagine. Even codes of modesty have everything to do with white supremacy and Christianity, but I mean, we know they're like Christian supremacy and white supremacy are like in bed together. So it's all of it. It's what we consider polite. It's what we consider a lady.
Yeah.
Just deconstruct all those words just a little more and a little more.
Yeah, according to, you just have to keep asking yourself, according to who? According to who? And eventually you get to according to who, and it all goes back to white supremacy, which is what the kind of book is trying to make the point of, but then also how to navigate it. So talk to me about how your relationship to whiteness has changed or morphed, or how has it grown, or, you know, whatever, since writing this book, because, you know, it mentioned that you once got interviewed by Telemundo, but they wouldn't air it because you're views were too radical, right?
I
imagine that this book has pissed a lot of people off. So how has your relationship to whiteness changed?
It's been really well received so far, and I think it's because the people who are buying it are people who have been following me for years and kind of understand what I do. I'm waiting for the critique. I really, really am. In fact, I feel like more prepared for critique than I was for praise. So I'm like, when people compliment it, I'm like, oh, they made us. How nice. Thank God. Like, cause I really have been anticipating. I know where every sentence I wish I would have cleared up better. I know. I mean, like, I can really tell you what all this imposter syndrome has been telling me for months.
Yeah.
So no, it's been really great so far. I'm waiting for it. Tell me when you see it so that I could like be like, okay, I knew I would happen.
Yeah. Well, because I mean, I don't think people like to be told about themselves. They just don't, you know? And so if these people like, okay, wait, I do want to get to the part where you talk about volunteerism, but like me, I was a volunteerist girl. So when I was reading this, I was like, I didn't even know this was what I was, but I remember So this whole thing, guys, everybody just, here we go. This whole thing started because I was listening to the book and I'm like I said earlier, I like to move around and do whatever when I'm listening to my book. I stopped dead in my tracks and I was just listening, like one of these, like you know, when you're like, fuck, I wasn't ready. Like it fucked me up in like this way that I didn't know that I guess I just kind of needed to be shooken up in that way because I had this experience when I was 14 years old. And I was involved in this church, First Church of the Nazarene. And I didn't know much about these like factions of Christianity, of like how they all had different rules. Girl, I didn't know. And I felt like that was something they should have let me know when I got baptized. Like, oh, by the way, you're not allowed to dance. Like, by the way, you know, like that's something I feel like you should say up front, you know, but they didn't say that. So my dumbass gets baptized and I'm like, okay, we're going to go on the trip, like to the, go visit Ecuador and build a church and, you know, do God's work, you know, whatever they tell you you're going to do. And I'm on this trip with like all these white kids, because that was what the church was. It was a church full of white kids. And I was the only one who went on the trip that had to earn their way on the trip, because I didn't have the money to pay. The whole trip was $2,000 and everybody else just paid it. But me, so they gave me an opportunity to earn my trip. So I would have to go and do like yard work or like paint a fence at the people's houses of the church. So the kids that I was going on the church with, church trip with, I'm at their house painting their fence in order for me to go. So it already sets up this kind of like power dynamic, which like, yes, I feel like you kind of helped me understand in the book. And as this is happening, you know, like I end up going on the trip and I came back and I no longer believed in God, because it was like a whole experience that I was like, this can't be real. It didn't match with my experience, with what I thought God meant. And yeah. I remember listening to your book and just kind of being really convicted about that part. You know, can you talk a little bit about that part and your experience with volunteerism?
Yeah, my family, so our church was built and sponsored by Gospel Outreach. It's like a huge, I mean, you'll still see commercials about them. California-based Christian network that of churches, but they also do like the commercials, be like, for $5 a month, you can like help a child. And it's like, yeah, this white old man hugging this brown kid, like in the eyes of it, like all that. That's Gospel Outreach.
Not Sarah McLaughlin. Don't use Sarah McLaughlin against us.
But it was like that kind of church, and the founders were white people, and so I think that really sets a precedence for like how I was raised to think white people were, which was like in my parents' eyes like really benevolent and great and like giving. But as a kid, I'm just like, what are you doing here? Oh, we're just gonna plant trees that we could do. And so my family was in a bigger house and my dad was a pastor there, so a lot of them stayed in our house, and so we would like form these like
in Nicaragua, right?
Yeah. But yeah, my dentists were white missionaries. A lot of my toys came from donations that they gave, and it's just what I understood. And then when I was in divinity school and started getting the language for it, it was like an aha moment. Like I was like, oh, when you understand history, this is really awful. This is really icky. This isn't cute. And so now a lot of what I do is to call out a lot of that sort of self aggrandizing labor that white people do just to be like, we're so awesome.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, doing all these horrendous things back home and voting horrendously and supporting. Yeah.
It's more of the wanting to be seen doing something good. And you had this moment where when you got to college, you walked into a friend at the time's dorm room and see a volunteerist picture of him and a brown child, and talk a little bit about that and what that moment was like for you.
It was weird. It was, he had this picture with all these little brown kids. He's just like in the middle. It was just so weird because they look like, you know, they look like my childhood pictures. They look like my cousins. They look, it just was very jarring. Like I was like, ill. Like when would you go anywhere here and take pictures of like be in the park and be like, hey kids, come over.
It's very zoo attraction-y. Like what? Yeah, I don't know. That was a part that I had a problem with too. So I'm like on this trip, dude, and I'm like angry the entire time, but like not understanding why, and feeling like I'm on this trip with these people and I'm a part of their group, but I don't want to be a part of their group. And I'm like pushing back at the things they say and the things we're doing. And then I got in trouble a lot on the trip. And one of the kind of culmination to the trip was on the way back. Like I went to the airport jail because this boy said that I went to school with N-words and wetbacks and or whatever. You probably shouldn't say that word either. But he said that, and I slapped him in the face. I turned around, like, on the plane. They had pushed me to this point, okay? So by the time I got there, it was like, bro, this is your fault. And so the pastor guy, like, got me, and then they demanded we all get off the plane. And so, I had to go to airport jail, and, like, they were saying that if I didn't calm down, it was a risk and all this, but whatever. So on the trip, like, we're being called these missionaries, right? So they're telling you the story about what you're going to go do, right? Uh-huh. So on the way there, I'm thinking that this is going to feel one way. But then when I get there, it feels gross. Like how you were describing, like, this feels gross to me, and I can't understand why, and I can't explain why. I just hate all of you now. And, you know, it was like this this experience that is hard to explain, other than kind of like what you say, other than like, ugh, like you just feel gross. So this story is like, it's like an epic story. But the reason why it, you know, it triggered me listening to the story in your book and just like being taught this word, volunteerism. Like, it's interesting. It's crazy to me how a word, you know, I was a rhetoric major. So words create reality. So that word volunteerism, being able to name something like that, you know, and it gives you like a different perspective of my own life and what role I played in the experiences you had as a child experiencing that. You know, it's crazy. Sorry, I felt like I had to unload all of that on you.
No, it's good. Because, like, it puts a lot of context. And I'm like, I didn't know that part about you, like, just, like, socking someone.
Yeah. I kind of tried to allude to that in the DM I sent you initially. I'm like, Priska, I need to talk to you about my life on this book and how it changed my life. Like, it was really, I can get intense, like, when I'm you probably, I feel like you probably know, too. Like, those of us that are like, this kind of like speakers, we get excited when you want to share something or learn something new.
Yeah.
I'm definitely that kind of person. I mean, you wrote a whole book with the whole concept, so I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So in the book, it says it tackles racism, colorism, classism, the immigrant experience, and more in ways that are honest, relatable, refreshing, and inspiring. So the book, you know, the book is, like I said earlier, it's like this, you're speaking for us in a generation-wise, like the same way Gloria Anzaldúa was speaking for that generation of, like, kind of, because it's not just a book of poetry or a book of, there's like a lot of facts and figures and like, it's research, it's like theory, it's, you know, so it's not just like a creative work of art. Talk about that. Why did you balance that with it?
Because it is a lot of theory that gave me the language to have all this stuff. So I was just like repackaging it. Like, no sentence stands alone. Everything has a citation. And if I was allowed to, there'd be footnotes in after every sentence, but they said it looked too academic. So
you're like, you're writing a textbook, sweetie.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have to move away from that concept. But I really, really believe that these books are great. They just aren't written for the people that I want to be in community with. So that's the whole point of it.
What has been the most surprising reaction to the book?
The praise has been really surprising.
You said you were like bracing yourself for like, what are you bracing yourself for? Like, what exactly, who did you think was going to trip on it?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I have an anxiety disorder, so you just make up like the most wildest scenarios that aren't no one's thinking, and I don't even want to say it out loud to plant it in someone's mind that these are my biggest fears.
Yeah.
So it's just, it was just all popping up. So although, like, my Amazon reviews are like amazing.
They really are. I was reading them. I'm like, they love her. The people love her.
I know. I'm like, oh God, Dios mío. I am not prepared for this much love. So that's been it.
Dude, you deserve it. You deserve it. How long did it take to write this? I mean, it was a collection of essays you had written previously, but then how long did it take to put the whole entire thing together?
Started in March and it was all due September.
That's like no time at all. Yeah. So when you get to that level, like that's what they're expecting. They're like, okay.
No, I didn't think it was true. I signed on the dotted. I knew who I was going with the 1st of November. No, like October. I knew my publisher. We had agreed, and they were like, "Go on, start writing." And I was like, "This is all a lie." And so I see money or I see a contract, it's all a lie. And publishing so slow that I didn't see a contract till January. Yeah. And then I kept thinking like, and you know, then I get the contract and give it to my lawyer. So this whole time I'm just like, this is all stupid. This is taking advantage of me. I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
And then I get paid in March and I was like, oh fuck, this is real. Get
You're like, okay, I got the commas. I see the commas in the bank account. It's not real until the commas are there.
And then the panic set in that I was like, oh. I said I was going to finish it by September.
Dude, So tell me like about those days, like when you're like, I don't know what, like, was it more putting it together? Like, okay, these are already things I've written. Or was there's also, I mean, I'm sure you had to write in between to join these things together. So it was more putting together or more writing?
When I finally decided what I was going to do, it was how I do my talks, which are, again, that same method of democratizing knowledge. And so I do read pieces, but I do a lot of middle stuff to explain why makes sense. Because a lot of it can be poetry for me, or a lot of it is really just like I'm weaving with words trying to explain this thing. So it can be really repetitive. It's like almost like a cadence of a Pentecostal sermon for me. So I do need like those breaks when I'm doing my talks to explain what I'm doing. And so I just did that on paper instead of what I do in my normal talks. But yeah, it's so doing all that was hard. It was really hard. And I wrote a lot of new stuff. So revisiting stuff, revisiting topics I wasn't sure of. I was also like moving sometimes because the whole thing is intersectional. So when I'm talking about like a thing like colorism, it's hard to not bring in like class and other things. So yeah, I was also like moving passages around, being like, where does it make the most sense? when does this chapter start to sing is like what I refer to it, because there's a moment when you fit all the right pieces and it's just like, okay, good. And I feel that I did that really well, to be honest, only in 2 chapters. So what people are reacting to some of the other chapters, I'm like, oh my God, good. Because sometimes you're your worst critic. So it's good to hear that it like lands well, even if you're critical of it all.
Definitely. What kind of larger impact do you hope your book like has on social consciousness? I mean, like, I'm talking decades from now.
I hope it can be seen as, so my editor called it, my editor was like, I don't know what genre this book is, because
yeah,
there aren't,
yeah, because it's
do this.
Yeah, that,
so I
there's storytelling,
yeah,
then there's like kind of the part that makes it kind of like a textbook, because you literally give the, I didn't know shit about the Sandinistas, I didn't know anything about any of that, and I learned things in this book that not only were like about personal narrative, like, oh, I can relate to that, but it's like, no, you learn also history. So where do you categorize this book?
I put it in a storytelling as pedagogy genre. And so I hope that there's like a plethora of these books that I have like started this movement to democratize all this stuff in different perspectives. Cause I can only tell that what it's like to be a non-Black Latina from a working class context, Nicaragua specifically. So what does it look like to have that story told in a Honduran perspective? So what does it look like in Colombia and different parts of Colombia? Like, I'm just like, let's go. I want to hear all the stories. And I hope that the ending, I say that, like, I'm like, go on, tell the story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, you go into the wound to find a lesson, and it'll help so many of us.
It's extremely inspiring. It definitely is. And it says, you know, may this light a spark within you. I believe that's the wording you used, and it definitely is, and it definitely will. I do see it as being that, like, again, you know, the same theme of your life has been trailblazer, you know, like somebody to do it first, and that is special. So I just want to say that I'm really proud of you too, just like as somebody that I get to know, like I actually can hit you up and tell you how I feel about the book. That's like something cool, because you, it makes it that much easier that you can grasp it that much like closer, you know, it makes it that much more possible to take your writing to, you know, bigger places. And it's so, it's like, what advice do you have for, you know, young writers, young brown girl writers that maybe are just starting out and are barely even journaling, you know, using writing as a form of healing right now, you know, maybe they want to take it to professional one day.
Right, right. Often make your own little blog and start writing, start using your, become your biggest advocate. Use your writings in your own Instagram across social media. It's like, right. I was discovered on the Huffington Post discovered me on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Like, people are looking for different voices. It's not a lot of people, but there are people looking for it. And when just create, and don't be like, no, this piece has to be perfect. It literally will never be. That's so release truth. Your writing into the world and let it flourish. And like, my stories back in the day sucked, but I had to tell those stories to tell the stories that I've written down now.
Well, I don't know if they ever sucked, so let's just be clear. But because I've been a fan of your writing for as long as I've been following you. I wanted to see, do you have the book next to you? I mean, it's right behind you. I wanted to see if you were willing to read a little bit of the, you know, the dedication, the For Brown Girls part. If you would read like a couple lines from that, it's just so beautiful, and it's like a perfect note to kind of like close out on. But before we get there, I also want to, you know, ask you a question about this, you know, because about the imposter syndrome and about you know, feeling like you can't believe all this is actually happening to you, even no matter how much work you put in. What kind of spiritual hygiene do you practice, like to keep yourself balanced in this kind of like chaotic, it seems like, I mean, in this part of it's going to be chaotic, you know, the book just came out. So what kind of spiritual hygiene do you practice to stay balanced?
I do limpias. I have a lot of crystals. I do it all. I'm like sniffing lavender sometimes. Like
snorting lines of lavender.
Yeah, like I do a lot of, or like I have a friend who sends me crystals and sometimes I forget to clean them, or, you know, like run them through water. So she'll be like, Mujer, go run them through water right now. So I also have like a lot of brujas in my life who are just like, what do you need? I'll send you some incense right now.
Yeah.
But I do a lot of practices just to like reset even. Like I cut my nails really short after a big event I did recently. Like I'm constantly trying to like release myself of like energies, and just you could just, there's a lot that happens when you're vulnerable for a living.
Yes.
And there's a lot that you have to do to take care of yourself to be able to keep doing that long term. Mm-hmm.
Those of us that have, like you said, struggle with anxiety, there's this social battery that kind of like runs out, you know. And especially when you're, it's so interesting to be a person who struggles with that, you know, and but is also constantly in the spotlight, like on purpose. Sometimes I do it and I'm like, why do I keep doing this to myself? Like, it stresses me out right before I do it, but then once I jump, I fly. And I know, you know what that feels like.
Yeah, that's like my whole entire life actually. But yes.
I think the inspiration here is that you pulled the curtain back with this book and you showed all of the brown girls with tender hearts and sharp edges that their voice matters and there's a place for them, and where there's not a place for them, they can make a place for themselves. And so, yeah, I want to end with having you read some of the dedication. As much as you want, if you want to read the whole thing, please do. It's just so inspiring and so beautiful to see everything you're doing. I love watching you shine and I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. I think I'm going to read, I don't know.
Dude, read whatever you want.
Okay, hold on. I'm trying to figure out. Okay, I'm just going to read from the last page of it from Partners on. So, partners have tried to pin you down. They have tried to claim you, but you've resisted because you're not meant to belong to anyone. You belong entirely to yourself. Your laugh carries liberation in it. Brown girl, do not let them take away your passion, because they will try without any compassion to keep you down. But remember that without passion, you will extinguish. And so to be safe, make sure that you keep others nearby who can pick you up and light you back up again. Because brown girl, we need each other.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
On behalf of all the brown girls with sharp edges and tender hearts, I just want to say thank you for writing this book. It really, really makes a difference. And we just love to see you keep shining. So keep on doing that.
Thank you. Bye, girl.
Bye. Speak soon.
Yes.
This has been the Millennial Mija Podcast. Thank you all for listening. Love you.
Hello?
It's the Mother Fucking Millennial Mija Podcast.